On Tuesday, April 23rd at 6 p.m., the DSR Network and the New Republic will be co-hosting an evening featuring a conversation with Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg. The event will take place at the National Press Club. If you are a member and live or will be in the D.C. area and would like to attend, please email Riley Fessler at rmfessler@trgmedia.com. That's rmfessler@trgmedia.com. We have a few seats still available and would love to see you there.
This is Words Matter with Norm Ornstein.
We've got the votes and screw the rest of you.
And Dr. Kavita Patel.
These might be some of the smaller moments, you know, with all the bombshells. Didn't catch people's eyes.
Hello and welcome to Words Matter from the DSR Network. Each week, Norm Ornstein and I will talk about the issues facing our country as we come out of one election cycle, hop into another, and seem like we're in this never-ending, it feels, Norm, like we're in one of those like just constant like turntables, you know, entry doorways. We're going in and out and in and out of not just cycles of news, but I feel like the ups and downs of democracy tilting on its head. So I got to be honest with you. I spent a lot of time this week in between other things, a lot of time monitoring Donald Trump's sleep and trying to understand and make sure that the former president was getting as much nap time as he needed during jury selection for his criminal trial that took place this week. That's certainly what caught my attention. I know we're going to talk in our members pod about some interesting developments during oral arguments in the Supreme Court that I really am excited to hear your take on. What other news items caught your attention this week? And do you agree that the never-ending horrible saga of our former president was a good distraction for you early this week?
It certainly was. There's one other thing that at least is worth a mention, Kavita, and that is another entry in the hypocrisy Olympics, which is the House finally sent over to the Senate the articles of impeachment against Secretary Mayorkas, a cabinet officer impeached by the House, not because there was even an allegation of a high crime or misdemeanor, but basically because they didn't like his policies. So I watched the House managers, quote unquote, walk these articles over to the Senate, and somebody tweeted appropriately, look at the diversity there. And there was some diversity. It was white males. The diversity was probably between 45 and 65, and one woman. But then the Senate, not surprisingly, basically summarily dismissed, voted down the two articles, adjourned the trial. That was that. The hypocrisy is this. Mitch McConnell, Tom Cotton, Mike Lee, and others went ballistic, saying this is the lowest moment in the history of the Senate. Yeah, January 6th might have qualified, among other things. But you know, not even to hold a trial is outrageous. Why is that hypocritical? Because they all but five Republicans in the Senate, when the second impeachment against Donald Trump for inciting an insurrection came over to the Senate, they all voted not to hold a trial and just to let it go. So it just sometimes boggles the mind at how if you do it, it's horrible, even if you happen to have a very strong case. If we do it against the weakest case imaginable, that's okay. And that's just the typical pattern.
Yeah, it is. That's a great, I'm glad you called that out. And I thought you were going to talk about my other favorite Tom Cotton line this week, where I forget what day it was, Norm, but there was like a day where there were several protests around Israel-Palestine in in major urban centers, San Francisco, New York, and a handful of other cities.
They blocked the Golden Gate Bridge, and I think that's what got him going.
They blocked the Golden Gate Bridge, where he basically said, like, people should take justice into their own hands and throw people across off the bridge. I'm slightly paraphrasing, but actually not slightly. Pretty much, it's exactly what he said. And at one point, like on Fox News on the website, they actually had run that, you know, kind of clip. And then I think at some point realized, hey, we should probably take this down because we could be accused of inciting, you know, street justice and murder. Yeah, which is, so I thought, you know, Tom Cotton, here's the, I know that our show is not about Tom Cotton, so we should get into the trial in a second. But I do want to also ask you, to me, let me just say, as a parent who thinks about like the fact that if I had to apply to college today, Norm, I don't think I would get in. But, you know, just thinking about the fact that here you have like someone, I think he was Harvard undergrad, Harvard law, decorated, I'm pretty sure if I remember correctly, decorated military, or at least, you know, military experience, and didn't have any issues there. Man, is this like a case study? And doesn't really matter where you go to school. Like, some people are just broken. I don't know if that's like the take home here. But
so, you know, Harvard has Tom Cotton and Elise Stefanik, who has also tweeted out some utterly ridiculous, erroneous, and outrageous things. Josh Hawley, who is just as bad as Tom Cotton, is Yale Law School. You know, when Tom Cotton makes a remark like that, they ought to revoke his law degree or bring him up for disciplinary proceedings. For a lawyer to basically call for people to take the law into their own hands and kill others, it seems to me would be worthy of a disciplinary proceeding by the bar, which won't.
Right. This is, Norm, thank you for, maybe we will not just talk, but maybe we'll do a smaller amount on the Trump trial, because I'm so glad you brought that up. I remember clearly working in the Senate, and it wasn't like in the dawn of time, it wasn't that long ago, where if I failed to report like things to Senate Ethics Compliance, that I could have been not only fired, but Senator Kennedy could have actually had like an admonishment. And I think at the time, Feinstein, when we were in the majority, Feinstein was chair kind of ethics. And I remember very vividly like how seriously everyone, Republican and Democrat, took like that role of the committee and the role of like the Senate to kind of police itself. And I got to be honest with you. Like, I mean, it is such a far cry from that, not that long ago. And I didn't hear bupkis about it. And it could be that the media didn't cover it. And that maybe there was a universe where like Senate Republican and Democratic leaders admonished his comments. I didn't hear it. Did you see anything?
Nothing at all. And while we're on the topic of the Ethics Committee, I have to raise one other issue.
This might be a more interesting conversation than our planned conversation, yeah, to be candid with you, because this is exactly what the media is not reporting. Exactly. There was a ton of media coverage about Donald Trump falling asleep.
Yeah.
But this actually might be the more valuable thing for listeners to hear. Go ahead.
So, you know, years ago, when Wilbur Mills was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, the New Yorker did a cartoon that had a picture of the doorway, and above it, it said the Ways and Means Committee, and they had written in the powerful Ways and Means Committee. I would put the word feckless above the entrance to the Senate Ethics Committee. So here's this case. Ted Cruz does a radio show, right? Says over and over again, I don't get paid for this. The company that owns the radio network gives, I think, $160,000, don't hold me to the exact amounts, to his super PAC following this. First of all, he's basically lying. Second of all, he's getting enormous compensation, even if it isn't coming to him directly, it's coming to his direct control. And if this isn't a blatant violation of ethical standards in politics and possibly illegal, although the Supreme Court may have something to say about that, it's hard to imagine what would be. And so far as we know, you know, admittedly, much of the work of the Ethics Committee is done behind closed doors. But what we also know is the Senate Ethics Committee has not admonished anybody, done anything about any potential violations of ethics in years. It is hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, or even as you know, Bob Dole once said about the gathering of three former presidents, the third one being Nixon, hear no evil, see no evil, and evil.
Evil. Yeah. I remember that. That's good. That's good.
You know, it's just, and this is why, you know, I'll go back a little bit in history. I spent a lot of time on and am very proud of the work that I, my colleague Tom Mann, and some others did to get created the Office of Congressional Ethics in the House, an independent entity that could at least begin preliminary investigations before sending it to the House Ethics Committee of violations of standards by members and staff. When Barack Obama was in the Senate, Harry Reid, the majority leader, gave him the portfolio of looking at ethics matters. I worked with Obama on this, and we made a proposal for an independent Office of Senate Ethics, which the Senate rejected and rejected again. And it was this sort of egoistic, we have integrity, we can do the job ourselves. But it's worked out not that far from what the Supreme Court has done with its absence of ethics and now a sham code of ethics that's been violated even as recently as yesterday. And it's just, it's too bad. I love the Senate. You love the Senate. We both work there. But this is no way for a body to act if it wants to maintain its own integrity.
And that's the key there, right? So there's a little bit of this like kind of cognitive dissonance, right? Like just this leadership with shift with Mitch McConnell, you know, Chuck Schumer just basically trying to do, I mean, Schumer, to his credit, sticks to script, right? He knows what gets attention. He knows like what fights he wants to fight, and he kind of ignores the rest. However, that is not what makes a leader. And it'd be really interesting. You mentioned Bob Dole. I would just bring up, you mentioned Harry Reid. I'm going to bring up Tom Daschle. I'm going to bring up other Democratic majority and minority leaders. I can't imagine like that they condone the lack of action. And I think that what I want kind of listeners to take away from this is not necessarily that, you know, we just need to get rid of Tom Cotton. Yes, that is true. But the inability to kind of articulate what a threshold is for the conduct becoming of not just a senator, but any elected official, this includes the House, it's only damaging to democracy. You might want to say like, well, that's just Tom Cotton and that's just Stefanik, that's just Marjorie Taylor. Oh, fine, let all those people do themselves in. It actually undermines democracy and it erodes at any trust that even people like myself and you, to your point, who've worked and respected the Senate have. Because so I actually, this bringing it down to the real world, I get, you know, probably like you do, I get outreach from kind of younger people who are trying to kind of find their way in DC. And I spoke to a young woman who said that she was really interested in getting involved in policy and just was, you know, asking me about the administration and what would I think if there were a change in administrations, et cetera. And I said, yeah, it's a hard year with an election year. I would love to tell you that, you know, statistically the incumbent will win, but obviously that's been proven wrong. And so, you know, you just have to roll the dice. I brought up the Senate and she actually just point blank kind of looked at me. This is on Zoom. And she said, well, what's getting done in the Senate and why would anyone want to work there? That seems worse than working, you know, in the administration. And I would never have thought that before. And it's so funny because it kind of took me by surprise. And I said, yeah, I probably wouldn't myself want to work in the Senate today. And so it's not just the erosion of like the institution, but you know, you've got young people, the whole thing that makes Washington work is this kind of, I don't know, it's a little bit like Hollywood. You've now spent both times, like you've been in kind of the Hollywood of DC and the DC of Hollywood. And you need these like young idealistic people to kind of come and like really want to work for regardless of party and idealist, like kind of whatever their ideological stance might be. You need these young people with this fresh energy and this enthusiasm and this perspective to keep these cranks and turns. And we don't have that. We just don't have it. Nobody wants to come and do this. Norm, they all want to come. Like, I'm sure they'd much rather intern for you at AEI or, you know, they'd like to be at a, you know, at DARPA or learning about AI or doing this. And nobody wants to go work in the Senate. Like, nobody kind of sees it as like, this is incredible. And what a historic opportunity to go work for fill in the blank. And that's a problem. That's a problem that the public probably doesn't appreciate, because it is like that core of staffers and people who fade in like the walls, you know, during Senate and House hearings. That's actually the cranks. That's what keeps not just DC, but that's what keeps policy moving. And we're not going to have that. We don't have it.
No. And, you know, I used to know a lot of people who were career Senate staffers and very proud of that.
Right. You and I both do.
Very hard to find.
You know, Bill Doster, yeah. Who works for Sanders, who worked for years for Baucus. Yes, of course. He was my first intro to, we had something called the bag for Senator Kennedy with all the paper memos, and everything got Kerry's last look, you know, and I got more education from Kerry doing an incredible job of nuancing like the messages and the way the senator spoke and all. I mean, just, yeah. Who's going to do that now? Nobody. Who'd sign up to? I wouldn't send my worst enemy into this environment.
I want to come back just for a minute to the Ethics Committee and mention a few cases. You know, look, you can sort of analyze without approving. You have a very closely divided body, and both sides want to avoid some kind of explosion that could really exacerbate matters, which is no excuse. But Bob Menendez, wait until, you know, there are charges brought, and then, well, we can't do anything. Let the criminal process go forward. But even worse, think about Ron Johnson getting these phony elector papers, taking them in and trying to use them to overturn the election results. Josh Hawley inciting violence, putting his fist out there, and then, of course, running like a scared rabbit away from what was going on. Mike Lee on the floor talking to Trump or to others and basically having already discussed some of the things that might be done. I am frustrated that these people have not been prosecuted. They should be prosecuted. There are a dozen House members who were up to their eyeballs in incitement and helping to plan the violent insurrection against the Capitol. But at minimum, how can you let those kinds of things go by without some kind of statement from the Senate that they violate the most fundamental principles of the oath that these people took to be in the Senate? It is such a failure of responsibility and duty.
Now you're just going to make me more angry, and we're probably going to like get my skin and blood boiling, which is not good, but it's such a dereliction of duty. Yet because of this like wide chasm that you and I've talked about ad nauseum about the media and also probably just the public's disgust with it. And even a little bit of like my, you know, it's almost like, what is Tom Cotton saying now? Like, what is Josh Hawley saying now? What is J.D. Vance saying now? And what you're pointing out is that they've taken the bar of sanity or reasonable, like, you know, decorum, lowered it so much that you and I don't even expect it or expect anything better. And what does that say? That's like what our standards are set forward, and that what will history books write about like these moments, or what will be the, like, I'm actually going to try to look this up after we record, Norm. I'm curious, like, kind of, you know, how kind of the Google traffic for some of these like terms, because you know that like Tom Cotton makes this passing comment, throw people off a bridge. Next thing you know is there's probably a bunch of people on different online forums that talk about doing that. It's not like some idea, it's a reality. And then it just feeds into this kind of anti, you know, take it back to our good friend governor in Florida, Ron DeCrappis, and he just then feeds this into this like anti DEI kind of, you know, anti woke sentiment that he's trying to propagate through the educational system. I mean, think about how many levels that goes through, and think about his education. You and I just talked about Ivy Leagues. Where did Ron DeSantis go to school? Right, like this is a really, really, really troubling time, combined with the lack of a public appetite to think about the truth. So, okay. So before we go to our members only section and close out this part, I got to get you to close with your take on the Trump trial, since we're talking about the truth, seeking the truth. What were your impressions and observations other than, let me make my one medical observation, that in classic narcissistic behavior and in classic personality disorders, we often see the individual with those disorders kind of using the fact that they themselves have these issues and deflecting it towards others. So Trump for months now, maybe years, kind of sleepy Joe, making fun of Joe Biden's age and making fun of his fitness. When he was falling asleep during the jury pool selection and the hearing proceedings in the initial days this week, it's everything that he accused Joe Biden of doing, but he himself kind of has to struggle with his own age and probably his own like short-term attention. And it just reminded me, like, medically we know that like when people with these narcissistic and personality disorders otherwise kind of lash out at others, it's often a reflection of themselves. That was physically true this week. So that's my only observation. I'll let you go now with the, give us your assessment of the trial and what your observations were.
Well, one reaction to what you just said, which is a broader one about Republicans generally. The one word we should always keep in mind is projection. It's with Trump, it's with all the others. When they accuse Biden or Democrats or outsiders of things, it's almost always the things that they do themselves. And it's projection and deflection. I will give props to Maggie Haberman, who was the first one to point out that Trump was nodding off and falling asleep. But then, you know, even though it's been mentioned a lot, if Joe Biden had done this in any setting, it would have been banner front page headlines and the subject of multiple op-eds. And whether it was the Times or others, it didn't make the headlines. It was just a sort of sidebar in the story. And that's why people look at Joe Biden and say, oh, he's too old. But they don't make those observations about Trump. And that's frustrating to some degree. Now, the trial. First, the historic nature of this. As Donald Trump, when he goes out and rants, says, this has never happened before. He's right. You know why it's never happened before? Because we've never had a president who committed fraud like this, or a former president. What's so striking to me, beyond the fact that Trump keeps violating the rules, and Judge Marchand is probably now going to, in some way, hold him in contempt for violating the various gag orders. And I worry very much. I'm seeing reporting giving all the characteristics of the jurors, which will enable some people using search engines and AI to identify them, that we're going to get threats against some of these jurors. But still, what's striking is they're moving through this process. They're talking about very probably starting the opening arguments Monday or early next week, although Passover will intervene for several days in the interim. This trial is moving along. And, you know, much of the public commentary has been about, well, you know, it's basically all on the statements made by Michael Cohen, his former lawyer, who's an admitted perjurer, who served jail time. But if you look at what they've been saying and what they've been doing, this is more about documents than about what Michael Cohen will say. It's more about the paper trail, the cover-up. And of course, we also know that it's not just about Stormy Daniels and the payment made to keep her story right after the Access Hollywood tape emerging, which the Trump campaign believed could be the death blow for him. It's also about another woman who was, caught up in the same kind of National Enquirer catch and kill, try and keep these stories from being public. And if there is any testimony that's more significant, along with the paper trail, it's David Pecker. What a name for that former.
That's right.
Who was the one who basically conspired with Trump. And it wasn't just, by the way, about, paying off people to keep stories quiet that were embarrassing or deadly to Trump. It was also putting out these phony stories when Ted Cruz looked like the top competitor to Trump, that he had had multiple affairs, that his father had conspired to kill JFK. And, you know, for probably a lot of Republican primary voters who saw those stories. And so there's a lot going on here in this trial. And it's, you know, I see a lot of people, including some I admire, like Ruth Marcus, Rick Hassan, saying, this is trivial stuff. I think that's absolutely wrong. This is very significant election interference and fraud. And the only way Trump gets out of this, if he were to get out of it, it's not by acquittal. It's by somehow ending up with one juror who basically will hold out no matter what the evidence says, because it's a juror reflecting his observation that I could shoot somebody in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. And I think the jury selection is going along in a fashion that that's less likely.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you're spot on. You hit on all the points that kind of, I feel like, have not necessarily floated to the surface. And and Maggie Haberman deserves all the credit. And I do wish that there wasn't as much, I'm mocking it because, again, of this projection is a better way to phrase it. I keep calling it narcissistic personality disorder because that's what I've diagnosed him with, but it's both. And so I think that you're touching on some of the important sets of topics and just kind of what will be coming forward. So let me close this so that we can let our listeners get some extra time to process what we've talked about. And if they're interested, please join us by becoming members, because we're going to have I will certainly be educated by this conversation, since the only kind of Supreme Court kind of issuances that I paid attention to were around transgender care in Idaho. And I think that'll be something that you and I can discuss. But I want to make sure we spend some time in our members podcast and thank our listeners for joining us. Join as a member because you can get access to the bonus segments as well as to other aspects across the DSR network from our other companion pods that membership allows you to have extra or additional access to. And if you could just help us by sharing this episode with your friends on social media. Words Matter is a production of the DSR network. The executive producer of the network is Chris Cotnoir, and the producer of Words Matter is the amazing Riley Fessler. Our next episode of Words Matter will be in your podcast feeds around April 25th. See you soon.